Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
So, Dr. Steve Meyer, back with us today. You've been a frequent guest on our program. Thanks for joining us from your busy schedule out there in Washington State.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom.
We are today focusing on this new book. It has been causing tremors, I would say, in the scientific world. It's not that long. I just got my copy a few days ago from Oxford University Press. I think it's about 125 pages or thereabouts. Well, actually, the conclusion chapter is the little kind of a skip beyond that. But we are desiring today to set forward a little bit of the essence of this book. We don't want to go into much detail, because it is kind of a heavy-duty tour of the thoughts of Thomas Nagel and why he believes that there's something missing in the study of the world, the mind, the cosmos, and why evolutionary biology and its at least its materialistic foundation is seems to be leaving something out. And so as you have worked, of course, from your own post of study there and writing as a research scientist, a thinker, a developer of the theory of intelligent design, and, of course, with your background in the philosophy of science from Cambridge University in England, would you agree that this is a significant development, Thomas Nagel's new book?
Well, I think it is. He's one of the really eminent philosophers of science in the United States. He's a self-described agnostic, even atheist, and he has come to an increasing disenchantment with what you might call materialistic worldview that has flowed out of modern science, and he thinks that science is leaving some really fundamental questions unanswered from the standpoint of a strict materialistic approach, at least. And so one of those questions is the nature of mind, the nature of consciousness, which he argues cannot be explained by reference to the underlying chemistry of the brain. There's a difference between my experience of red and the chemicals that are coursing through my synapses and so forth. Similarly, the cosmos itself is something that requires explanation, and he has, in recent years, been also influenced by some of the work of people in the ID research community in making the case against neo-Darwinism and chemical evolutionary theory, and he mentioned some of us in his opener, and actually goes so far as to say that the scientific community should be grateful to these ID disreputables because they're raising questions that other people have been reluctant to raise, in part because they have, he says, an underlying unspoken commitment to an anti-religious worldview. And he thinks that that's blinding people to some really obvious questions, some obvious concerns that materialism can't explain.
Yes. On the phone with us today from Redmond, Washington, is Dr. Stephen Meyer. He is the director of the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute. And he's the author of Signature in the Cell, a best-selling text on the origin of life, explaining why using Darwin's own reasoning and the available evidence today, we should conclude that the information-rich resources of high technology and genomic information would point, even in the first cell, the origin of the first cell that filled with that information would point to an intelligent designer. And Dr. Steve Meyer, you have actually been figuring in the story of Dr. Thomas Nagel, if I understand correctly, the fact that your book made the list of the top 100 books of the year 2009 on the very secular London Times Literary Supplement, that has some connection with Dr. Thomas Nagel, does it not?
Well, Nagel was selected as one of their 10 book recommenders, I guess. And I knew nothing about this, but it was, I think, December of 2009, and I got a call that my book had been selected as one of the books of the year for the Times Literary Supplement. The Times, in this case, is the London Times, and the Literary Supplement is their kind of highbrow literary journal, something similar to our New York Times Review of Books. And so it's very kind of secular outlet and not a place we would have expected to be giving commendations for books making the case for intelligent design. But Nagel gave a very favorable review in the Times Literary Supplement to go with his recommendation, and there it was. So what ensued was a really spirited debate in the letters section to the Times Literary Supplement, and they published several rounds of letters. The first round was several people attacking them for having allowed Nagel to make this recommendation and attacking Nagel, asking what on earth had gone wrong with this guy that everyone had previously respected. And then Nagel responded, and then eventually I was allowed to respond to several of the letters, which were oddly really setting the table for me because they were arguing that I was overlooking certain origin of life experiments that had shown that you could make progress on building life from simple chemicals. And I showed in my response that each one of those experiments, one or two of which I had mentioned in the book, but all begged the question as to the origin of the information. The investigators doing the experiments were actually putting the information into the experiments in order to get them to move in a life-friendly direction. And so they actually illustrated, if anything, the need for intelligence to generate information. They didn't simulate an undirected, unguided process producing an information-rich system or molecule. So it was actually quite a great opportunity to reinforce the message of the book and to expose more people to it. And they published several rounds of letters about it because it was so controversial, I guess, that they'd allowed Nagel to make this selection. But anyway, it was a great thing for us. But we had since learned that Nagel had kind of gotten a lot of flack from people. It was pretty obvious from the letters, but he probably received some stuff back channel as well. So we thought probably be the last we'd hear from him on the issue, having experienced what so many of us have experienced in just taking this position publicly. Mm-hmm. But lo and behold, I guess it was earlier in the summer, we learned that this book was coming out with Oxford. The title and subtitle were provocative enough, but in his opening chapter, he essentially doubled down. He is not an ID proponent. He doesn't accept the conclusions that we finally come to, but he does accept our critique of neo-Darwinism and materialistic theories of the origin of life, and is exploring some other non-materialistic metaphysical solutions to the big questions of life.
Right.
And he does that. He does that very deliberative and thoughtful manner in his book. So it's definitely worth a read.
Well, the entry of Thomas Nagel into this new stage of the debate is certainly something we want to pick up on in the next segment. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door. And we are back with Dr. Stephen Meyer. He is an expert on the origin of life issue. He has written a book on that topic, a full-length, very meaty treatment. It'll tell you everything you wanted to know, but were afraid to ask about the origin of life and the current state of the research. But there's a bonus in that Dr. Stephen Meyer intertwines with that assessment of the research his own story of getting involved and engaged with the study of this fascinating topic, the beginning of life on Earth. And he also includes, interwoven with that story, the story of the development of the intelligent design movement. I would assume it's done pretty well. It must be in its like 39th printing. I'm just probably exaggerating a bit, but I imagine you're at least somewhat pleased with the explosive response to that book.
Well, the embarrassing thing for me about that book is that I started the project when I was first teaching after I'd finished my PhD. My son was a year old, and when I finally finished it, my son was a senior in high school.
That's a labor of love across 18 years.
I wasn't working on it the whole time, but the concept for it was a long time in coming, and it took a while. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. And of course, you've been part of the unfolding story of the ID movement or research community, and you've written a couple of good books on that topic yourself.
Well, thank you. Well,
honored to be on your show, Tom.
Yeah, well, it's an honor to have you. I mean, when people say who runs the intelligent, who directs, I should say, the research program of intelligent design, I usually, we'll just put it in a very simple term. Well, there's many, many outstanding scientists, but the lead scientist who is doing his own research and coordinating all of this is Steve Meyer at the Discovery Institute. So for you to be with us is a rare honor. And we do want to go right into the story of the critique of that book. There was a response that was published in a journal, which is known as a sort of more or less conservative Christian hyphenated scientist journal. It's Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith. I believe that's the correct name. But the Perspectives journal ran kind of a hit piece, a rather lengthy review article that, in my view, did not really show the quality parameters or level you would expect an article in Perspectives to manifest. And after a little bit of negotiating, they finally allowed you to respond to that critique. What is one of the things that is coming, let's say, from evolutionists, whether theistic or agnostic, atheistic evolutionists?
Yeah, and the journal you're referring to is staunchly committed, I would say, to the theistic evolutionary perspective. I'm a member of their Association of Scientists, but most of the scientists are theistic Darwinians of some kind. And the reviewer was no exception to that. His name is Dennis Venema, young biology professor up in British Columbia. And I was, in one way, disappointed in the review in that it didn't actually engage the argument that I made in the book. In another way, oddly, came away from the whole experience with a sense of validation, because when an author makes an argument and the only criticisms of the argument made by the author are straw men, are critiquing straw men, then it strangely makes you feel that maybe you're onto something, you know. So
yes.
Here's the breakdown on that. In Signature in the Cell, I argue that the digital code stored in the DNA and RNA molecules points decisively to a prior intelligence. And I argue that because of what we know from experience, which is that whenever we see information and we trace it back to its ultimate source, whether we're talking about a piece of software or information embedded in a radio signal or a newspaper headline or information inscribed in a rock surface like the Rosetta Stone, whenever we trace information all the way back to its ultimate source, we always come to a mind, not a material process. When we're talking about the origin of the first life, we realize that to get life going, you need information in the form of the four-character digital code in DNA and then RNA expressed in building protein. And living organisms, even the very simplest living organisms, indeed contain these information-rich biomacromolecules. So the question is, where did that come from? And in the field of origin of life studies, which is all about the attempt to explain not only the origin of life, but the ultimate origin of the information necessary to build life, we have a complete impasse. There is no accepted materialistic theory for the origin of the first life, precisely because all of the different theories that have been proposed have failed to account for that fundamental element of any scenario for building the first life, which is generating the information necessary to build all the proteins and protein parts out of which cells are composed. So the reviews of the book, rather than addressing that argument, my argument is that intelligent design constitutes the best explanation for the origin of the information necessary to build the first life, ultimate origin behind life. Instead of addressing that argument, what my critics have done is to say, hey, there's no problem explaining the origin of information. Look here in this fill-in-the-blank biological system. Because of natural selection and random mutation, this system got a little more information over here or a little more information over there. And some will point to the mammalian immune system as an example of new information arising as a result of mutations and selection, or others will point to other biological events. But they're always events once you have a living organism, once natural selection and random mutation can be part of the explanation, part of the process. They don't address the question, which my book addressed, which is the question of the ultimate origin of information. And so I titled the reply to Professor Venema as Venema's straw man or something like that, because he simply didn't address the argument of the book. There's another website, the BioLogos website, which was part of the BioLogos Institute or Foundation, and that's another theistic evolutionist group. They were started by Francis Collins, the famous geneticist involved in the Human Genome Project, and the current director, Daryl Falk, ran, I think, at least three, and I think it was no less than five critical reviews of the book. It was somehow up their noses. But the most prominent review was published by a guy named Francisco Ayala, who's a really famous and towering figure in evolutionary biology.
He's world-renowned, is he not?
He got the title of the book wrong, the topic of the book wrong, and the argument of the book wrong.
Did he read the book?
I think he clearly didn't read it.
And, that's crazy.
They didn't want to publish my response because I challenged him on the science. And then they came back with, well, you're just a philosopher of science. But book review, in fact, it made a lot out of junk DNA, which if you've been following the recent developments with the ENCODE project, second or third generation follow-on from the Human Genome Project.
Yes.
We're now learning that the so-called junk DNA is not junk at all. And recent estimates show that at least 80% of the non-coding regions of the genome are performing important functions. And that's a lower bound estimate.
Right. Well, let me just redirect, since we're a little bit short on time in this segment. In the next segment, we're going to be moving into this area of how you can discern a signal, as you use your title is Signature in a Cell. And I think it's so clever because like there's a signature of intelligence. And I want to just, if we could, move back into what you have indicated is Darwin's own wise, savvy, very sharp way of thinking. So we actually, in a way, taking Darwin's own tool of reasoning and using it in this case, the origin of life, and showing that, hey, Darwin's cause-effect reasoning leads to a design conclusion. So if you can stay with us, can we discuss that in the next segment?
You bet.
Yeah. So, and I also want to reminisce just for a little bit about the incredible opportunity I had, along with maybe 3,000 or 4,000 people, to hear you at the Ligonier Conference. And I understand that the CD and the DVD of that is available. We're going to strive to get that information up on our website by the 1st of November. And so, but Signature in the Cell author Stephen Meyer going to be with us again to discussing these important topics of origin of life and the indicators of design. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. We'll be right back. We are back on The Universe Next Door with Dr. Stephen Meyer. I remember when you came to the symposium where Philip Johnson, who had recently emerged as the leader of this fledgling group of skeptics, you know, high-powered, intellectually savvy skeptics of the Darwinian theory. We didn't even have the name intelligent design. That wasn't even on the horizon, I don't think, although there was the design inference that you and Bill Dembski were developing. But at that conference, I remember you taking on Michael Ruse, the famous philosopher of science who had devoted his life and still is doing that at Florida State University, to expounding the doctrines of Darwin from that philosophical vantage point, from the catbird seat of philosophy. And I was enthralled with the way that you pulled out your intellectual rapier or your lightsaber and you took on the great Michael Ruse. I don't know if you remember that, but that was quite a...
Well, I remember it very well. It was the first major academic paper that I'd given, having finished my PhD. And Ruse was very nearly my... one of my external examiners at Cambridge, and they ended up choosing someone else, but he obviously was on the other side of the issue. But The great thing about Michael is he's just a tremendously congenial fellow. And after we had our exchange on the podium, and he was arguing that intelligent design was unscientific by definition, and he was using what were in the philosophy of science by that time understood to be untenable definitions of science to make that conclusion. It turns out that any definition of science that you would use to exclude intelligent design would also exclude Darwinian evolution from consideration of science. So, for example, you say to be a scientific theory, you must refer only to observable entities. Well, that would get rid of the idea of intelligent design because that's referring to an unobservable designer acting in the past. But neo-Darwinism also refers to unobservable transitional organisms and past mutational events. And so, by the consistent application of that standard, you disqualify both theories. But nobody wants to say that Darwinism isn't science. So if people have attempted to use that kind of a strategy to disqualify ideas they don't like, it ends up almost invariably coming back onto the idea that people are hoping to defend. So it's increasingly viewed as an untenable way of arguing to support one view as being scientific over and against another. The more important question is the theory true? So I made those arguments in response to Ruse, and they're mainly this skepticism about what's called the demarcation principle, this use of definitions to settle arguments. It's pretty pervasive in my field, and so Ruse actually backed down fairly quickly and later told me, well, these are only arguments that we use to keep the creationists out of the public schools. But anyway, he was very friendly afterwards, and we had a very good talk. And
right.
But it was something I remembered because when I thought that I'd been matched up with someone that was already so well-known, it was a little
intimidating,
fear and trepidation that I came to the conference, but it all worked out very well.
Well, I love the name, you know, the conference. Darwinism, is it the scientific inference or philosophical preference? And what a great way to capture the key question. In other words, is this a compelling scientific conclusion that we're inescapably drawn to, or is it something that we favor even before the first piece of data is put onto the table? Because of our own personal philosophical realm. Now, as we're moving into your course, you came then to Washington State and taught for a number of years at Whitworth College. Is that correct?
That's right.
Philosophy professor.
In Washington State, yeah.
Yes. Exactly. And then, of course, after that, the opportunity came to move into full-time research and writing and leadership of developing the theory of design, working with Discovery Institute. And you got involved in a research project that kind of entangled you and your colleague out there at the Biologic Institute, Dr. Richard Sternberg, in a bit of embroiled controversy at the Smithsonian, because in the period of, let's say, 2003, 2005, in that period, you were submitting a research paper on the Cambrian explosion. And I understand you're writing a book on that now.
And that's right.
If you could just tell us a little bit about your research paper and what happened to it. If you could just do that, you know, take 2 or 3 minutes and just sketch through that amazing story.
Yeah, you bet.
Story.
Well, this, I published it in 2004. Mm-hmm. And it was an extension of the information argument to look at the question, not just of the origin of the first life, but the origin of the first animal life. And the first animal forms come into the fossil record in a period called the Cambrian. And what we know post Watson and Crick and the wake of the molecular biological revolution is that information runs the show inside living organisms. And that's as true of multicellular organisms as it is of unicellular simple cells. So if you think about building an animal, and if you think about that from an engineering point of view, and you say, what's required to build a fundamentally new form of life, you very quickly realize that you've got to have information and a lot of information and new information. You can't just copy the same old code. You've got to have new sections of code. And in fact, we now know that it's not just the information in DNA that's necessary to build an animal, but there are other forms of information, structural and positional information that isn't stored in DNA that's also necessary to what biologists call body plan morphogenesis,
yep.
The building of new form. So here's a simpler way to illustrate what I just said. I used to ask my students a question. If you want to give your computer a new function, what do you have to give it? Students will immediately raise their hands and say, code, software, information. And the same thing is true in life. If you want to build a new form of life from a simpler pre-existing form, you've got to have a lot of information. And so the article I wrote and submitted for publication and review to the Proceedings of the Biological Society of Washington, which is the technical journal that's published out of the Smithsonian Institution, made the argument that neither neo-Darwinism nor any of the current evolutionary models have accounted for or explained the origin of the information you would need to build a whole new animal body plan, such as the body plans that arose in the Cambrian explosion. In fact, I described the Cambrian explosion not just as an explosion of form, but as an explosion of information as well as form. And analyzing the question of the origin of the Cambrian animals in that light, I showed that neo-Darwinism simply lacks the creative power to generate the information that's required to build these new forms of life. And I showed that the same was true of many of the other current evolutionary models. And then at the end of the article, I argued that intelligent design did explain the origin of information, again, because of what we know from our uniform and repeated experience, which is the basis of all scientific reasoning, that information arises from an intelligent source.
And that's when the plot thickened, right, for Richard Sternberg?
Yeah, that's when the other shoe dropped. In fact, when the article was first published, it was quiet for about 8 days, and then the roof came off the Smithsonian. They couldn't get at me. I was at an independent think tank on the West Coast, but they made the editor pay and took away his office, his keys, his access to scientific samples. They transferred him out from his research group under the supervision of a friendly collaborating scientist.
They harassed him, in a word, didn't they?
Yeah, and they put him under the supervisorship of one of the administrators in the museum. They went to the NIH where he had a dual appointment and tried to get him fired. It was a hellish situation that he went
through. And I know, since we're a little bit short on this segment, that what he went through actually led to something of a congressional inquiry. They couldn't bring any action, but at least a watchdog agency was able to look into that and found that he was very...
No, there was a congressional committee that reviewed his case and found out that he had indeed been harassed.
That he had been harassed. And of course, he is one of the lead interview participants in the opening section of Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And of course, Dr. Richard Sternberg was featured in our own conference, Shaping Your DNA Destiny, which we'll be publishing the entire CD set on that here in the coming weeks. Well, we've had a delightful tour of the terrain of origin of life, the inference to intelligent design with Dr. Steve Meyer. He is the author of Signature in the Cell. We'll be right back with him after this quick break on The Universe Next Door. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. Please stay tuned. We are back with Stephen Meyer, Director of Center of Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute, and he is the author of an earth-shaking book that came out just a couple years ago. It's now in paperback form, We're going to be featuring that book this week on our website, Signature in the Cell. Now, what we want to do in the remaining segment is I want to go kind of deep and wide. Sounds like the name of a song I used to sing when I was
a church song there.
That's right. I want to go deeper and also want to go wider to the implications. But deeper is that we have in this DNA code that you've written about in Signature in the Cell. And it's the same thing that really is sent almost a little signal to Thomas Nagel, this atheist philosopher who released just this month through Oxford Press, Mind and Cosmos. He picked up the signal, and that's why he writes in the subtitled, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. I mean, them's fighting words. And so when Thomas Nagel, leading atheist philosopher, is saying, I'm looking for a new worldview, a new Weltanschauung, a new way of putting together reality that accounts for consciousness, that accounts for, cognition and awareness of love and purpose and the virtues and all that we treasure as life. I mean, would you not say, Dr. Meyer, comment on the implications of design? Design theory doesn't tell you who the designer is. But it doesn't discourage you from asking who the designer is. If anything, it just says, hey, this leads you to a new door. Check it out.
Yeah, I think that's right. It goes back to what you were referring to as far as Darwin's reasoning. Darwin used a principle of reasoning that had been established earlier, as far back as Newton and probably further back. But it's a common sense principle of reasoning, and it was especially applicable to historical sciences that are trying to determine what happened to cause something to occur in the past. So if you're trying to explain the origin of life, you want to explain it by reference to the causes that we see operating around us today. The principle is known as the vera causa principle, or the true cause principle.
The present is the key to the past?
Also sometimes referred to as uniformitarian reasoning, where our present knowledge of cause and effect specifically should guide our reasoning about what happened in the past. So, for example, if I live in Washington State, and if I were to go to eastern Washington and find a layer of ash, volcanic ash, and I were to see this white powdery stuff and ask myself a question, well, how did it get here? Well, I could think of a number of different hypotheses. It might be a flood or an earthquake, or I might propose that it was a volcanic eruption. Now, which one of those explanations is best? Well, the best explanation is the one that invokes a cause which we know from experience is capable of producing the effect that we see before us. And in that case, the volcanic eruption hypothesis is best because we've seen volcanoes produce that white powdery ash and we haven't seen earthquakes or floods do so. And so using that same kind of reasoning, as Darwin did in The Origin of Species, I actually turn tables on the Darwinians and show that the evidence from modern biology is pointing not to the denial of design, as Darwin deny design, but instead to an affirmation of design, to a real designing intelligence, because what we have inside the living system is, as I termed it in the cover on the book, a signature of intelligence. And that signature of intelligence is information. And the reason that information is a signature of intelligence is that every time we find information and we trace it back to its source, we come to one and only one known cause, and that's intelligence. So using our uniform and repeated experience, we can conclude that some mind, some conscious agent is responsible for the information in DNA, but to answer the question of who, we need further philosophical deliberation.
And so in a way, the work of intelligent design has its own rightful place within science and is doing good.
We're using a standard method of scientific reasoning,
yeah,
and we're applying it to scientific facts that everyone in biological or physical sciences accepts, mm-hmm, but we're using it to challenge the materialistic perspective and the denial of design that's pervasive in science. Mm-hmm. And we're saying, look, the evidence is actually pointing another direction. It's a philosophical predilection that keeps people from seeing the evidence and its implications. It's not the evidence itself.
Right. And Nagel really speaks openly of this in his book. He says, I would like to defend the untutored reaction of incredulity. In other words, he's trying to defend the standard thinking person who is incredulous to this reductionist neo-Darwinian account of the origin and evolution of life. It's prima facie highly implausible that life as we know it is the result of a sequence of physical accidents together with a mechanism of natural selection. And he expands on that, and he basically says those who have been attacking or trying to marginalize the intelligent design critique of Darwinism, those attacks are manifestly unfair. And I just thought it was really, I was impressed with an atheist philosopher, in effect, coming to the defense. Let me just read what he says here. Another skeptic, David Berlinski, has brought out these problems vividly without reference to the design inference. Even if one is not drawn to the alternative, this is Thomas Nagel on page 10 of his new book. Even if one is not drawn to the alternative of an explanation by the actions of a designer, the problems that these iconoclasts, that's you, Steve Meyer, these iconoclasts pose for the orthodox scientific consensus should be taken seriously. They do not deserve the scorn with which they are commonly met. It is manifestly unfair. From Thomas Nagel. Those are powerful words.
Yeah.
So in terms of current science, I remember when Michael Medved was there on the stage with you and with Dr. David Berlinski and with me, and when we featured you at our big event, you know, in 2010, Signature in the Cell. I remember Michael Medved saying, you know, some people say, oh, if intelligent design wins, they will shut out evolutionary teaching. That's not at all accurate. Would you say, wouldn't you agree that the position of design theorists is that if anything needs to change, we need to teach more evolutionary biology than ever? Would you explain that?
We have thought for a long time, this is obviously a contentious issue. And the way you teach contentious issues in the public schools is you teach what we call teaching the controversy. Mm-hmm. If you have a history class and you are teaching about, say, the New Deal in the 1930s, you don't just teach the Republican view of the New Deal or the Democratic view of the New Deal. You teach what the Democrats argued and what the Republicans argued, and you present those arguments fairly as the proponents of the arguments themselves would have made the arguments. And that way, you allow the students to think for themselves, and then you discuss the competing perspectives. Mm-hmm. So we presently, as a caveat, are not pushing to get intelligent design into the public schools at the secondary level. It's already being discussed quite openly at colleges and universities, but our object right now is to win the scientific debate at the highest level. Mm-hmm. And we have found, as a prudential matter, that it's kind of a distraction and one that has brought a lot of pressure on scientists who hold the design position within universities to have these court cases and things like there was a court case several years ago in Dover, Pennsylvania about mm-hmm. intelligent design. So we're not pushing for that as a prudential or practical matter, as a matter of policy. But it doesn't seem to me, as a matter of pedagogy or even constitutional principle, there's any sense in saying, well, you can teach Darwinian evolution or you can teach chemical evolutionary theory, both of which deny design and affirm a strictly materialistic account of the origin of life or the origin of subsequent living forms. But you can't teach the opposite point of view or the arguments for the opposite point of view that there is an actual design. Neo-Darwinism claims that living things give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose, but they weren't really, because there's an unguided, undirected process, namely right. mutations and selection,
right.
that can produce that appearance or illusion of design.
And so,
what's the other point of view? Well, the appearance of design isn't an illusion, it's real. Right. Mm-hmm. And are there reasons to think that? So, right now, it's in this climate, it's probably not wise to be trying to get intelligent design taught in the public schools.
Right.
But from a constitutional point of view or pedagogical point of view, I don't think that there's anything wrong with teaching competing perspectives about contentious issues, especially when the arguments and the controversy about those issues is live. So what we've been recommending for the public schools, by the way, is simply that people want to remedy some of the indoctrination that goes on about Darwinian evolution. The best thing teachers can do is to teach the scientific criticisms of Darwin's theory as you find them in the current scientific literature. That's legally unassailable, even in our present climate, and it's good science pedagogy.
Well, we've had a great tour of this topic of origin of life, the bombshell book from Thomas Nagel, Mind and Cosmos, and the work of Stephen Meyer. Dr. Stephen Meyer, thank you so much for joining us on The Universe Next Door.
Thanks for having me, Tom. I appreciate being with you.
And thank you for listening to our program. See you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.